The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello there. This is Fred Brack reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Time to return to the July 2022 edition, Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. The theme this month is the agriculture issue. It says Green Acres. And we're going to be reading these first two articles that they're featuring. Cotton Comes Back in Northampton County and Rice Revival in Pamlico County. I think those are the two we're going to be reading. We're also going to read about Hemp's, H-E-M-P apostrophe S, homecoming in Harnett County, and pawpaws rediscovered in Watauga County, County rather, and we will see how much we can get to after that before we, of course, cover the current decade story of the 1980s in the last reading of the month. But let's get started with the comeback crops. It says cotton, rice, hemp, and pawpaws across the top here. And I guess that's the title page for the whole series. The small farmers are changing the face of agriculture in North Carolina, reviving crops once considered to be obsolete in our state. In doing so, they honored tradition and bringing communities together. Some pictures here. It says, in the sprawling fields from the coastal plain to Appalachia, independent farmers are reintroducing, and they're showing the pictures on the opposite page, cotton, rice, pawpaws, and hemp. So, of course, we have hands holding some fluffy cotton on the plant. I guess you don't call it a vine on the plant. And then we have the rice and pawpaws, with which I am not familiar, so we'll have to read that article, and hemp. So the first article in the series of, I think it's four or possibly five, is Rewriting the Story of Cotton. On a sprawling farm in rural Northampton County, a young black farmer entrepreneur is teaching people the value of an ancient agricultural tradition with deep, dark roots. And here are two men standing in a field of cotton in their they're covered head to toe, even have hats on their head to keep out of the sun, to keep their heads protected from the sun, I guess. It says black cotton founder Julius Tillery and operations manager Jamal Garner are exploring the stereotypes of cotton farming in eastern North Carolina. 30 miles southeast of Roanoke Rapids, across a flat expanse of Northampton County that produces cotton, soybeans, and little remaining tobacco, is the tiny majority black town of Rich Square, named for its fertile farmland. Julius Tillery's family had tilled this part of the Roanoke Valley for more than 100 years. There's no outrunning your roots, the 36-year-old cotton farmer says, standing beneath an eastern red cedar, surrounded by graves of his ancestors. One of them is great-great-grandfather, the Reverend D.L. Tillery, was born in 1871, the first child in the family to live his entire life free. In the early 1900s, he bought the first portion of this land, which now grows 75 acres of soybeans and 50 acres of cotton. Julius waves his hand toward a path that cuts across the field. From that tree line to this tree line right here, he says, that's the first of our family farms. He looks back down at his great-great-grandfather's gravestone. His parents were slaves, Julius says, then nods to two other markers. That's his wife, Ellen, and that's his sister, Mary. Julius comes from a long line of cotton farmers and has dedicated his life to preserving this agricultural tradition so laden with knotty roots. In 2016, he started Black Cotton, a company that takes the crops that he grows in this part of northeastern North Carolina and turns them into intricately designed art puffy white wreaths, tree ornaments, arrangements, totes, and other decorative items and accessories. But Julius's mission is much bigger than creating home decor. He aims to free cotton from its associations with a troublesome past. Depending on who you are and where you're from, cotton could come with some heavy baggage. Many black Americans see the crop as an emblem of a painful history, slavery, and later predatory sharecropping situations. Julius wants black people to see pride in this traditional southern crop and admiration for the black farmers who've produced it over the past 100 plus years. Nowadays, he says, we value being highly educated, and we thank, or rather think, these country folks weren't doing much. But look how much they bought and how much they got with the education that they had and the things that they did. These black people were so resilient. When Julius isn't coming up with creative solutions for black cotton's production and marketing, he advocates for North Carolina agriculture. In the past, he served as the Farm Resources Coordinator for the Conservation Fund, as well as the North Carolina Coordinator for the Black Family Land Trust, which helps historically underserved landowners retain and maintain their legacies. Family farms, Julius says, shaking his head, there's nothing more complicated. Some landowners, he explains, see their farms only in terms of their monetary worth. Others see them as homesteads where old-timers can live out their days until they die. But black-owned farms have tremendous symbolic value. After all, it wasn't until 1865, just 6 years before Julius's great-great-grandfather was born, that black people were even theoretically allowed to own land. And even in recent years, of more than 46,000 farms in North Carolina, only 3% are owned by black producers, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In 2021, for his efforts in supporting and empowering his local agricultural community, Julius was bestowed with North Carolina State University's William C. Friday Award. Julius walks across the road that runs through his family's patchwork of land. Wearing a farmer's outfit of blue jeans, brown boots, and a white T-shirt, he nods to a big green combine parked in the field. "That's my John Deere right there," he says proudly. He stops at the edge of the field and turns around. "Some bowls out here," he promises, and sure enough, cotton plants punctuate the ocean of green that stretches all the way to the timberline. A couple of bowls are already open, little puffs of white fiber pushing through brown hulls. It's still early in the season, and Julius's plants are exceeding expectations. "This is going to be a good cotton crop," he says, bending down to count the white blooms around him. He smiles. "I think it's going to be an outstanding year." The telltale scent of cotton is potent well before evidence of the crop is visible. Its musky perfume of ancient moss and dirt spills into the hallways of a former elementary school building in Garysburg, about 20 miles north of the Tillery family farm. In classroom after classroom, shoulder-high drifts of puffy white bowls still attached to their husks and stalk are piled up and waiting to be turned into art. This one-time school building is now the town's community center where Black Cotton headquarters shares space with a local public library and farmers market. Inside one of the rooms, Jamal Garner, Julius's childhood friend and a Black Cotton operations manager, strolls from one pile to the next, breaking down the cotton bowls and separating out the seeds. Once the seeds are removed, he can begin designing one of the wreaths that the company makes and ships to customers as far away as Seattle. For products like these, the bowls are harvested and cleaned by hand. It's a meditative process, and for the wreath that Jamal is making, he carefully arranges the husks around the edges until he likes the way it looks. When Julius and Jamal were kids, they were taught that they'd have to leave Northampton County if they wanted to become somebody. Jamal enlisted in the Marines and traveled the world. Julius went off to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to study economics and entrepreneurship. While they were away, many of the black cotton farmers they'd known growing up chose to stop planting. Costs were mounting. The farmers needed help. But younger generations weren't sticking around small towns like Garysburg to learn and carry on the trade. Julius began to wonder if the rural world, as he once knew it, might become extinct in his lifetime. He was faced with a choice. I could have gone into banking or something, but I wanted to do something to grow my family's legacy, he said. What's the point of having a nice job and living somewhere like Durham with a middle-class lifestyle when your farm is on the line? Julius decided to come back home in 2016 and help revitalize his agricultural lineage. I told my dad, if we don't create something worth keeping this farm for, it's going to be lost. Black cotton is a remarkable endeavor in town, in a town that doesn't have much else to offer. No franchise restaurants, no major grocery stores, few gas stations, and only one Dollar General along the mile-and-a-half stretch of U.S. Highway 301 that cuts through Garysburg. With few groceries for residents to buy, a community is a food desert, something Julius and other farmers have improved by creating the area's first farmer's market. He also frequently hires locals to help Black Cotton harvest its crops and pack orders. And Julius pays his employees living wages in order to give younger people a blueprint that they can use to start their own business here. Julius worries that if companies don't invest in this majority black town and county, young people will continue to flee the area in search of better opportunities. We believe in this stuff, he says, and we want to show people that it's something worth believing in. Julius hopes to continue recruiting new believers, young people like Clarence Sean Bell. He's the great-great-grandson of Summer Fairfield Bell, who in 1923 founded a cotton gin 6 miles south of Garysburg in Ochinoche Neck. The Bell Cotton Gin is one of the oldest black-owned gins in Northampton County, and it was part of a community of Bells that also consisted of a family home place and a family-run country store. But the machinery ground to a halt in 2014 when Thomas Bell Jr., who'd run the gin for half a century, took sick. He died in 2017, and a couple of years later, Sean stepped in. After earning his degree in manufacturing from North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University in Greensboro, Sean went off to cotton ginning school in Stoneville, Mississippi, to prepare himself to revive the family business. I've always been around it my whole life, Sean said in a 2021 episode of the Land Ethics Podcast, which was sponsored by the Black Family Land Trust and hosted by Julius. Cotton is history, John says. Cotton is a way of life. Julia sees Sean's worldview and commitment to reopening the family's gin as another critical step in revitalizing black cotton farming in Northampton County. He's a young guy, and he's trying to come into this game, Julia says as he steps inside the huge building that houses the gin's dusty, faded green machinery and massive ductwork. I've been telling people that this cotton thing, it's generational. You just can't get up and buy a cotton gin. This right here, he points to the gin's two suction system near the ceiling. It's more than just infrastructure. It's the relationship with cotton growers. You've got to have workers who know this stuff. If families around you aren't in this, you aren't in this. When Julius looks at young people like Sean, the gears in his head begin turning. He sees opportunity. Sean's already figuring out he wants to have a high quality grade bales for clothing production, Julia says, which means that when Sean gets his ginner's license and reopens this place for business, Julius and Jamal will be able to bring their cotton here to separate the fibers from the seeds. And with that pivotal piece in place, black cotton can advance from creating home decor to manufacturing textiles. From there, who knows? Julius's ultimate dream for black cotton extends well beyond his family's patchwork of farmland and the old school building that serves as the company's current headquarters. He would like to see a network of black-owned agricultural businesses working symbolically, or rather symbiotically, creating jobs for young black farmers and preserving a rich tradition begun by men like his great-great-grandfather. Back at the family farm, Julius walks from one patch of land to the next. "This is my dad's stuff, and this is my granddaddy's stuff," he says. "The Tillery land," he explains, "has been used to grow everything from soybeans to peanuts, but cotton will always be closest to Julius's heart, and it's the only crop grown on this portion of the acreage." Sometimes, Julius says, he brings school kids on field trips to this part of his land and regales them with stories about on how on clear nights he can see stars much more vividly than he could if he were in the big city like Raleigh or Durham. "This land is like his own private planetarium. What's fascinating to me is to see children run," he says. "They just run. There's a feeling of freedom. Some kids, they come from urban areas, and they don't even know the feeling of running around a black-owned farm, of not having to wonder what white people are going to say or do." He hopes that when his own son, Acre Dakota, is older, he'll see the value in this land, too, and understand why his dad loves it so much. Julius reaches out a hand and caresses the mottled green leaves of one of his cotton plants, and a light rain begins to fall. "This is my spot right here," he says. "This is like my favorite place on the planet." Want more information? Visit blackcotton.us. And now, rice revival. Eastern North Carolina was once home to thousands of acres of Carolina gold rice. And then, about a century ago, those rice fields disappeared. In Pamlico County, this heirloom crop is back and coming to menus across the state. Written by Kathleen Purvis. Outside the tiny town of Oriental, just a few miles inland from Pamlico Sound, is a view that hasn't been seen in North Carolina in 100 years. It's rice. Get there at just the right time during Tidewater Grain Company's harvest season in August and September, and the green stalks will be shoulder high, each one topped with drooping amber fringes of rice that look like clusters of golden beads. The rice that's returned to these chessboard flat fields, where the elevation is barely 10 feet above sea level, isn't your basic long grain table rice. It's Carolina gold, the rice with a story that captivates historians and a taste that draws chefs who want that story on their menus. It even plays a role in a larger narrative of the cultural food traditions that enslaved Africans brought to southern tables. Until recently, Carolina gold has been a South Carolina story. It's the variety that put antebellum Charleston on the map as having the best rice in America, maybe the best in the world. Does it matter now that this crop is being harvested here in North Carolina? Having something in your cultural area that's grown in our area, that kind of deepens the story, says Chef Keith Rhodes, the owner of Catch Restaurants in Wilmington. Rhodes grew up in nearby Porter's Neck, and he's been quick to put North Carolina-grown Carolina gold in his menu. It hits home more than this is grown, just a few miles away from my community. There's a fascination with the story of Carolina gold, says David S. Shields, an English professor at the University of South Carolina and an expert on heirloom southern plants. The idea of a staple that at one time demanded the highest price in the world rice market, you can't say that about too many other heirloom American crops. And the quality of Carolina gold, if you have a well-cooked plate of rice with butter on it, it's an extraordinary thing. Carolina gold was grown all around Charleston before the Civil War, but rice plantations also moved into North Carolina, where the crop was grown in a few locations as far north as the Cape Fear River. But after the Civil War, it began to disappear in both states for several reasons. The biggest one, money. Carolina gold was more expensive to produce than rice grown in Arkansas, Texas, and Louisiana. And when dikes were breached by storms, there were no more enslaved people to provide free labor to repair them. The history of rice is tied to African heritage that remains vibrant in the American South, says culinary historian Michael W. Twitty, who recently tackled the subject in Rice, the final entry in the Savor the South cookbook series from the University of North Carolina Press. He likes to call Carolina gold the queen among queens of commodities, second only to King Cotton for its importance in antebellum southern agriculture. Enslaved people who were brought to the coastal South, including North and South Carolina, were mostly from Africa's west coast, particularly in Liberia and what is now Senegal and Sierra Leone. Rice has been grown here for thousands of years, and West Africans brought that knowledge with them. There's a definite link between rice knowledge and the people who cultivate rice, Twitty says. After the Civil War, rice farming hung on for a few decades until a series of hurricanes in the late 19th and early 20th centuries wiped out the levees that had protected the fields. But the industry was already waning. Carolina gold was being undersold in the global market, and it was a crop geared for hand harvest. The machinery that came along in the early 1900s was too heavy for muddy fields. Both Carolina gold and the Carolina's rice industry were abandoned, disappearing for almost a century. Then, in the 1990s, the movement toward embracing locally grown foods brought a renewed interest in restoring older crops that had been pushed aside for foods that had less flavor but were easier to grow, harvest, and ship long distances. At restaurants across the country, chefs started using their menus to tell stories and highlight flavors that our ancestors had known, a lot of them coming from seeds handed down like family china. There was also increasing demand among chefs for basmati-type rices, which are more aromatic than the more common japonica rice strains. The original Carolina gold, a long-grain rice, was rediscovered in the 1980s, leading to the establishment of the Carolina Gold Foundation, which works with farmers who want to grow this variety. Led by people like Glenn Roberts of Anson Mills in South Carolina, Carolina Gold took off with top chefs. Rhodes had been cooking with Anson Mills' Carolina Gold rice before Tidewater Grain's version came on the scene. The rice we're getting now from North Carolina, it tends to be a little fresher, he says, just a little more versatile, a softer kind of rice. Like several other chefs who are using it, Rhodes agrees that it's great for wetter preparations like stews versus drier dishes like pilafs. It has a great flavor, he says, and will hold its texture well. When we're making bogs, we can sprinkle it right in and it won't overcook. Bringing Carolina gold to North Carolina wasn't as simple as sticking seeds in the ground, though. In large-scale farming, risk can get expensive. So far, only one company has been willing to try it, Tidewater Grain Company. It's the brainchild of two lifelong friends, Al Spruill and Tommy Wheeler. Spruill is a fifth-generation farmer who understands how to cultivate field crops, while Wheeler spent most of his career as a NASCAR general manager. As young men, Wheeler went to Davidson College to study physics, and Spruill studied agriculture at North Carolina State University. Both men were members of the Killing Cans Hunt Club in the Pamlico County community of Whartonsville. Cans is a reference to canvasback ducks, a species that needs to be around water to dive down and find food. A duck impoundment, a place where waterfowl like to hang out, is really just a flooded grain field. Like ducks, rice is also a water-loving species. While rice strains in the South aren't grown entirely underwater, like Asian varieties, they still need fields that can be flooded for weed control after the rice sprouts. And when you flood the rice fields, you attract ducks. The Killing Cans Club started in 2009 with eight people who like to spend time together hunting. A few years ago, the members started to worry. They knew that for their club to survive into the next generation, it would need more land. And land, as anyone who farms knows, is too expensive to leave empty until hunting season. We were trying to find a different way forward, Wheeler says. How do we subsidize this? How do we get creative? Traveling around the country on hunting expeditions, Spruill and Wheeler had noticed that the states that were most popular with duck hunters, Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas, also grow a lot of rice. They started studying wetlands management and discovered that rice was once grown in eastern North Carolina. That gave them an idea. Instead of just growing rice, what if they grew a special rice, a rice for which chefs and serious cooks would pay a premium? In the culinary world, that's Carolina gold. They approached Glenn Roberts, the man who'd gotten Carolina Gold on menus from New York City to Los Angeles, and works with the Carolina Gold Foundation, which controls the supply of seeds. His first question was, why? Wheeler recalls. Like a lot of heirloom grains, Carolina Gold can be difficult to grow and harvest with lower yields. But Spruill and Wheeler stuck to the guns, and by night 2018, they'd pieced together small plots around their club's lodge until they had 120 acres that they could flood in one go. They built almost 2 miles of levees and used trenches to divide the fields into cells so they could plant the rice, flood it at the right time, then drain the water. For a little more than 100 acres of rice, that's a tremendous endeavor. Spruill and Wheeler invested $1 million in 2021 alone, digging a 360-foot deep well to provide enough fresh water and constructing a rice mill. When the crop is harvested, growers must mill it to remove the husks, leaving brown rice, which is then polished to get white rice. Broken rice grains are sold as Midlands or rice grits, which are softer and porridge-like when cooked, and as the dust is gathered and sold as rice flour. Tidewater also had to battle some unexpected problems, like a local critter that they dubbed the Whartonsville Terrorist. One night, a sensor at Wheeler's home went off, signaling that water was draining into from the fields. He rushed over and discovered the culprits. Crawfish were burrowing into the fertile soil that had piled up when Tidewater dug trenches, and the critters were making holes that let the water run out. Spruill and Wheeler reached out to sources in Louisiana to learn how to get rid of this vermin. The answer? Why would you do that? Crawfish and flooded rice fields can be a source of income. Spruill solved the problem by adding more heavy clay soil to the trenches, but in the future, he says, they may add crawfish to their enterprise. Tidewater's rice fields have yielded other benefits. North Carolina State is now doing its own research in an experimental patch that it has on the company's land. In another area, there's a field of barley that the company is growing for Epiphany Craft Malt in Durham, which works with brewers across the state. Tidewater is also sending rice husks and rice bran to Ranlew Dairy in Snow Camp, which uses the husks as bedding for cows and the bran as feed. The company's rice efforts are taking off, too, as cloth bags of Tidewater grain rices and rice grits increasingly turn up in stores, farmers markets, and gift shops all over the state. Chad Blackwelder, a food marketing specialist with North Carolina Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, has connected the Tidewater team with interested chefs. The chefs in North Carolina are going crazy over this product, he says. During planting season in April and May, Tidewater's 100 acres look like any other farm fields, wide swaths of small plants with deep gullies running between them. Looking at them, you wouldn't know it was anything historical about them. Look a little closer, though, and you'll see North Carolina turning something very old into something new. Using older strains of plants that haven't lost their flavor through planting and replanting gets us back to flavors that our ancestors might have known, Wheeler says. Well, that is about all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be back to listen to us next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's Reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency. Serving the community since 1974, they can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.